This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Kayla, and thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. We're always hearing about living in the present. Looking forward is greatly encouraged. But looking back, meh. Who wants to look back, right? The truth is that when we look back at our lives and at our history, it becomes the only way to gauge where we're at in the now. The Jewish date is the year 5781. We are told that the Messiah will come before the year 6000. That's 219 years. That's not a lot of time left. I wanted to find out about the Jewish Messiah, so I called up the man in the know, Rabbi Ken Spiro. Rabbi Spiro is a senior lecturer and researcher for Esh HaTorah Jerusalem. In addition, he's a licensed tour guide from the Israeli Ministry of Tourism. Here on Chai FM, you know him very well for his history series, his world-perfect presentations, and his many other talks. Welcome, Rabbi Spiro. Good morning, and how are you?
Welcome, and good morning. I'm good. Thank God. All is good. Just came back from Morocco.
And how was that?
Just experiencing a little of the Jewish past. Well, I lived there as a child because my father was in the U.S. Air Force for a while. He was drafted in the early 60s, but I have not been back since. So I don't remember too much of it back then, but I imagine it's changed a lot. It was a very fascinating experience. North Africa is a country very rich in history, and especially Jewish history.
Absolutely.
So it was a very, very interesting experience.
Well, we look forward to hearing your talks on that. Do you think we're living in messianic times?
For sure. I mean, you started with Kathy with a really interesting line about looking back. Winston Churchill, one of my favorite personalities of the last 150, 200 years, he had a great line. He said, the longer you look back, the further you can see forward, which is a very Jewish idea because, as King Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. And certainly, I always say Jewish history is the big black hole of even well-educated Jews' education. So that's why I like to focus on it. But in keeping with that thought, you know, everything we need to really understand about what's happening now and what seems to be unfolding before us really is, you know, based on our traditions, what we've seen in the past. And in terms of whether we're actually in the Messianic era, I mean, I don't know if we're in the Messianic era yet, but we're definitely very, very close to it. We're definitely approaching the end of days, which the rabbis, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who actually is one of the great European Torah scholars who didn't survive the Holocaust himself, but he wrote a book called Ikvasa de Mashiach, and in the footsteps of the Messiah, describing what we'd expect to see. It was, you know, based on traditional Jewish sources and his own insights into them, but it was remarkably prescient work, and he used a really interesting analogy, which is that the end of days and the approach of the Messiah is like a woman giving birth. And I always apologize at this point. No man should ever talk about a woman giving birth. It's not an experience men go through. And the only reason why I dare to comment on it is because I think it's educationally useful. And B, I've suffered through kidney stones a few times. I've been told, I can say firsthand, that it was a pretty unbelievable experience. So I dare to venture into that. But if I may be so arrogant as to venture into that minefield, I've seen all my kids being born, you know, that woman gets contractions. And as she knows, baby's going to come out soon because the contractions come closer and closer together and get more and more intense. And Rav Elchanan Wasserman talks about, he says, but there are breaks in between. That's why they're called contractions. He said, because if a woman didn't have breaks in between, the pain would might be too intense, and he says she might die in childbirth, heaven forbid. If you extrapolate from his analogy, you see that the major sign that we're approaching the end, so to speak, is events getting more and more intense and coming in greater rapidity, like the contractions get closer together. And certainly, if you're a student of history, like I say, you look back, we don't appreciate how things changed so slowly for so long. You know, great leaps in technology until electricity appeared, which made pretty much the modern world possible, you know, and combustion engines and steam industrialization, which is only a byproduct of the last, you know, couple of centuries. Very little in technology changed, you know, for thousands of years, nothing really changed, literally. And you think how rapidly things have changed in the world. A person who, let's say, has merited to live to be 100 years old. Think about a person who was born in 1921 how much the world has changed. Okay, you had basic technology then, but even things like telephone and automobile were just making their appearance in the world. And now we fast forward to the rapidity of change is just incredible. It's exponentially exploding. So in that sense, we definitely see, and also historical things, empires rise and fall. The Roman Empire was around as a great empire for half a millennia. Empires don't last very long anymore today. They rise and fall incredibly quick. Everything seems to be converging towards rapid change, political evolution, things moving so fast. And with technology and the internet, we're able to track them so fast, and it's real time, everything happening now. I'm sitting here watching, you know, Fox News, what's going on in Afghanistan. It's surreal that you can witness this stuff, that you can talk to a person in Kabul on a cell phone, you know, find out what's going on. So, in that sense, certainly the big picture, I'm not talking about the Jewish specifics of what we talk about Messiah, but in terms of that laying out that formula of more and more intense, greater and greater threats, whether we're talking about, you know, COVID or threats of nuclear war and all the things that are always floating around and giving us a lot of anxiety and the rapidity with which they're coming at us, it certainly seems that we are approaching that period of time for sure.
Are there any more specific signs that we could be looking for? So, for example, interstellar travel. Space tourism is in its infancy, but it's here. And I remember reading something, I think it was Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who actually quotes that pre-messianic times there's space travel. Are there other such signs that would basically confirm exactly what you're saying and that we are hurtling towards a specific point in time?
There's definitely sources talking about the explosion of knowledge and the growth of technology hinted at, although much of the vocabulary didn't exist, you know, hundreds of years ago. Terms were used like microbes, germs, atoms, subatomic particles, neutrons, electrons, DNA. These are all modern terminology, but there's definitely indications of an explosion of technology and knowledge in the world coming from Jewish sources. I've never seen anything about space travel specifically, but certainly that's on the cutting edge of technological evolution. What there is a lot of is discussion about what's going to go on with the Jewish people in the world and those signs. And that's what's really very, very powerful, that you see things sort of lining up exactly as the Torah describes them. Of course, keep in mind that we're talking about people like Ezekiel and Zechariah using when they exist, you know, when they're around in the world 2,500 years ago or thereabouts, the modern technology of today, airplanes, tanks, guns, nuclear war, modern nation states don't exist. So you have to kind of extrapolate when you read these prophecies. You can't take them too literally. When you talk about Zechariah, like you look about Ezekiel and Zechariah both talk about what's called Gog and Magog, cataclysmic final showdown when the nations of the world unite to come against the Jewish people. And we don't even know who's Gog, who's Magog, the king of Meshech and Tuval. In these terms, there's a lot of rabbinic speculation on what these countries are. But if you can pull back from the details and look at the bigger picture, you see that the recent events of the last like 100 years in Jewish history is a blink of an eye. You know, I always say ancient Jewish history is 4,000 years ago. Medieval, you know, is not by the classical definition, 2,000 years ago. But the modern Jewish history is anything the last couple hundred years. And if you look at the last 100 years of what's happened with the Jewish people, for good and for bad, you can see that clearly, and you pull out what the big picture of what's supposed to happen, you can see that clearly there's an incredible convergence of biblical prophecy and, you know, end of days predictions, you know, the notion of, and again, keeping in mind that in between when these prophets were writing and speaking, and today we had 2,000 years of diaspora and 2,000 years of Jew hate culminating in, you know, events like the Holocaust. But, you know, the prophets are talking about things like the Jewish people physically coming back to the land of Israel.
Which is happening.
Yeah, but it's amazing. Think about it. In 100 years ago, half of 1% of the Jews in the world lived in Israel. Today, it's about half the Jews in the world living in Israel. Mm. And that number is only going up. You know, you get huge boosts to the number with the Soviet Aliyah in the early 1990s when like a million people from the former Soviet Union came to Israel, and Israel's population jumped like 20% in literally in a couple of years. But it's a constant trickle. And with the diaspora shutting down, like you look at South Africa's Jewish community, which is, I believe, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was 120 something thousand Jews and is now down to less than half of that or half of that. You can see that the diaspora is shutting down. Some of these Jews are migrating to greener pastures. I know specifically from South Africa, a lot of them are going to Perth, Australia. Some are coming to Israel. So people still wander, but you can see Europe has definitely been shutting down, not just the Holocaust, but, you know, most places in Europe, it's no longer safe to walk around openly identified as a Jew. I've been saying for a long time that the last stop for Jews before we all come back to the land of Israel is going to be North America, specifically the United States, although Canada has a very significant Jewish population. But that's the most recently discovered colonized place in terms of Western civilization, but it's the last stopover in terms of a major community. But even there, the level of anti-Semitism, the threat level, and things have happened to Jews in America that never happened 10 years ago. Shootings in synagogues, open anti-Semitism, things like that. So in that sense, it's sort of like you can see that big hand from above shutting down the diaspora and bringing the Jewish people, you know, back to the land of Israel. So that's one really big sign.
You mentioned the prophet Ezekiel and Zechariah. There's also the prophet Isaiah. He's got that very famous prophecy from, I think,
swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks.
And when I think about that, I think you may even have spoken about this, is that whenever I think about us living in pre-messianic times, Haiti, unfortunately, Haiti recently had those terrible 7.2 earthquake. But 12 years ago, they had another earthquake. And it was the first time in world history that an army had been sent into another country, into a foreign country, to help. And Israel sent the Israeli army into Haiti to go and help with the search and rescue efforts and rebuilding Haiti. Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, Israel had the first. I remember the most interesting part of that was Israel had the first field hospital.
Exactly.
A fully equipped field hospital, which is, you know, in Israel and Haiti are quite far from each other. The fact that we beat the U.S. to that, given how that it's much, much closer distance being in the West Indies, was quite shocking, to say the least.
But isn't that really? I mean, if you look, a sword is something that is used for damage. Plowshares is a tool that you would use to nurture and to grow. And it's something very, very positive. So when you're beating your swords into plowshares, it's using something that was designed for war for something good. And we're seeing more and more and more of that around the world. And personally, I see that as a sign that we are living in pre-messianic times.
Well, it's interesting you say that because the analogy is quite, you know, we're talking about pre-modern world metal technology, exactly. Weapons and tools that come from metal, you know, are the opposite of each other. One could be very constructive, used for farming or construction, and one could be very destructive, used for war and killing. You see that exactly today. You can take that. Again, Isaiah didn't live in a time when they had missiles and computers and electricity, but a missile can launch a satellite into space for telecommunications. It could launch an intercontinental ballistic missile. So the potential for, because it's the power of science, which is neutral, is there clearly with all the money being spent, the $2 trillion the world spends on defense budgets. You know, if that was directed towards production of food, eradication of disease, education, water purification, there's no question that the human race has within its ability all of the technological know-how and the resources to deal with all the major problems that so much of the world suffers from. You know, that a billion people on this planet don't even have a toilet. You know, that's something that we could easily take care of. But at the same time, that technology, whether it's viruses that may well have escaped from, you know, Chinese laboratories that could have been experimenting on for, you know, God forbid, warfare purposes, which is technically illegal to do according to international law today, or nuclear bombs or whatever we have in this world, intercontinental ballistic missiles. So the raw potential is there to go either way. The question is precisely how it will be used. 100%. It's like Dickens says in The Tale of Two Cities, he opens up with the line, it's the best of times and the worst of times. You have the greatest potential to do good and to solve the world's problems, and the great potential to do incredible evil. And technology can be used to spy on people, and we can mass murder people now in a way that we could not do before. The Holocaust illustrates something that was unheard of before, that no one ever expected the most technologically, culturally, law and order society in the world to mechanize and industrialize murder on a scale that's never been seen before. So, you know, so you have coming from a country that had such great potential and was the world leader in Nobel Prizes prior to the war and prior to throwing all the Jews out of institutions of higher learning, then turning that into the absolute worst possible use use of technology for conquest, murder, and genetically weeding people out who were viewed as inferior, even including Germans who had handicaps. So I'd say it's very neutral. So the big question is, what's the worldview that's going to be the overlay on that, which will direct people in the right direction? And that is the messianic conception, which is the mission of the Jewish people has and always will be until the end of time to be the role model, the light to nations, the God squad, as I like to say, to live and act in a way and create a viable governmental, political, legal system based on the values we get from God that the world can finally unite around. Because imagine, forget John Lennon's song Imagine, which is the best worst song ever written. The words are so antithetical to Judaism, even everyone loves them. You know, no heaven or hell below, you know, above us only sky, nothing to live or die for. You know, the brotherhood of man, very, very universalistic worldview. The Jewish version of Imagine would be imagine all the people living unified with a relationship with our Father in heaven, all following the same values. No one on top of anyone else and dominating, but all of us working together to have a relationship with the creator of the universe who gives us this perfect system of government and values that we can run on every level, whether it's our own personal happiness, our families, our communities, cities, countries, nations, and the world. It's all there. It exists. There's nothing new under the sun. The whole system is there. We just have to get it out to the world. And again, you go back to the technology with mass communications, with the internet, with you can reach the entire world with messaging very, very fast. You know, there's a great line by, I think, Mark Twain. He said, a lie gets around the world before truth even has time to tie its shoes. But the reality is that technology is neutral. And when we're on message, in theory, it can be gotten out to the world very quickly. So the raw potential is there. The question is just which way it'll go, which is why, you know, the prophetic image of the messianic days is so laced with so many potential threats, because precisely because of these opportunities and precisely because we're at the end of this amazing story, you know, it's sort of like the last book I wrote called Destiny is basically based on an idea that the story beats of all the great epic books and or movies that we make out of them are all the same. There's a cosmic struggle of good and evil. There's a little superhero and a big bad guy, whether it's Harry Potter or Neo in The Matrix or Frodo in The Lord of the Rings or whoever you want to pick from any of these movies or stories, whether it's Voldemort or Saruman or Darth Vader. It's always a very unequal struggle. The little superhero isn't even aware of, you know, his role in the story, but because his role is so critical and because he has such a central role in so many, you know, hidden strengths, he can't escape his destiny. He's locked into it, whether he likes it or not. So he's always thrown into, at incredible odds stacked against him, confrontations with this big bad guy who should have beaten him and destroyed him many times over, but miraculously he seems to always survive and often come out stronger than he went in, even though he takes a beating in the process. And we know how it works in all these movies, because the end of the movie is always the final showdown, whether it's Luke Skywalker fighting Darth Vader or whether it's, you know, Harry Potter fighting Voldemort or Frodo against Saruman, you know, the eye. And good always wins and bad evil is destroyed and the balance is returned. And that really, in the book I make the point, and I show how it actually happens in reality, that we Jews are, forget the movies that we go to escape reality. We are actually collectively the protagonists in this incredible story. And every one of those story beats fits into Jewish history. Every one of them, exactly as it's laid out. And we expect, and humanity collectively, the reason the movies always go this way in the books is because on a deep level, we know this is the way it's supposed to be. Evil can threaten us, but good will win. But when you put that all together and look at the big picture, like I said, you see we're very close to the end. The final showdown is definitely approaching. Who it's going to be against, how it's going to work out, you know, those details, no one knows.
The battle between good and evil, it certainly is, I think, a universal truth. What has got me a little bit perplexed is that God creates both.
Right. Absolutely. Well, first of all, that's the very, you know, Christianity got around that issue by just making a devil, like a fallen angel who fights with God. And God's a nice guy, but sometimes he loses. It's much more harder emotionally and intellectually to deal with the notion of everything coming from God. That's the real innovation that Judaism brings into the world with this understanding of an infinite, invisible, omniscient, omnipotent, all-powerful, all-knowing being that we don't see the whole picture. If, like I always say, without getting into a whole class on suffering, if this world is all there is and you only go through it once and you're here for 70, 80, 90 years, 120 if you get lucky, then it's certainly not fair. It requires a certain understanding. But if you understand that, you know, you have a soul, there's an eternity. This is not all there is. The good, the bad, it's a much bigger picture. We only see a narrow sliver of it for a very short period of time. We make the mistake of looking at it that way, and then we come to conclusions. You know, on an emotional level, that's not to say when something bad happens, we're emotionally upset, we get angry. That's the way we work in this world. God is hidden from us, so it's much harder. If he appeared to us and said, you know, my child, this is, you know, here's the bigger picture, we'd be much more comforted. But that's part of the challenge of being human, is to have God hidden so we can exercise our free will and live in a world which is very challenging. But again, we don't see in our own personal lives, we certainly don't see the big picture, where we're going, why this happens. When we're dead, we get to watch God shows us the director's cut of our lives, and why all of our personal journey and the journey of human history is this incredible interplay between God's infinite knowledge and control and goodness and our free will. One way or another, we get to where we have to go, but it's this incredible dance between the decisions we make and the most godlike trait we have, which is free will, and the creator of the universe is absolute control. But that's really what the whole story is about of all of human history, is God giving us the ability to make decisions and earn individually and collectively our progress through this incredible journey that's, you know, on this little speck in the universe called the planet Earth, and what we understand to be human history.
You're on 101.9 High FM. I'm Kathy Kaler. This is Community in Conversation. Today, the conversation is about the Messianic era. And who is this Messiah guy anyway? Joining me to answer those questions is Rabbi Ken Spiro. Rabbi Spiro is a senior lecturer and researcher for Eish HaTorah in Jerusalem. In addition, he's a licensed tour guide for the Israel Ministry of Tourism. And here on High FM, you know him very well for his history series, his World Perfect presentation, and his many other talks. Rabbi Spiro, who is the Messiah?
That's the big question. We're getting so far afield in so many topics. We have to focus back on the question at hand. We don't obviously know who the Messiah is. We have to first start by going through a job description. So we understand that the purpose of the Messiah is to act as a catalyst. Since we didn't do it maybe in the ideal way, by entering the land of Israel with Moses, our leader, one way or another, we're going to get there. It might take a year. It might take several thousand years. In our case, it's taken several thousand years, as you pointed out at the beginning of the introduction to this whole little talk. There's a tradition in Judaism that by the year 6000, the Messiah is already here. Not he arrives by, that he's here, that we're already in the Messianic era, which if you do the math is pretty close, 219 years away. And there's opinions in Judaism that you can lop 200 off that period of time, by the way, that we're actually an interesting discussion of itself, but that we're a few decades away from that, but that we're already in that period of time. So we have this idea that we took the long route, but we're getting very close. And Maimonides then, what he does is he calls out the major things we'd expect to see from the Messiah, what he has to do in order to get the job. Bottom line is, to answer the question of like, who is the Messiah? Number one, he has to have a certain pedigree, which is from the family of King David, because the Messiah is a king in the traditional Jewish sense of kingship.
Very valid what you say, is that we do pay a lot of attention to pedigree. Who says that he's going to be specifically from the tribe of Judah?
This is a very clear Jewish tradition, since we understand him as a king, and since kingship comes from the tribe of Judah and from the family of King David. We talk about this. It's mentioned so many times in Jewish sources, this notion, the connection of the Messiah to King David. But that is, again, put that on the side, because that's the least important thing. If he can do everything else, I'll definitely give him the benefit of the doubt. What does he have to do? He has to basically restore, he has to bring all the Jewish people physically back to the land of Israel. Like I mentioned before, we already see that the world's population since 1948, when Israel was created as a state, has gone up post-World War II by about 340-350%. The Jewish population of Israel has gone up by more than three times that amount. It's the fastest growth of any country's population in human history. So that's number one. The second thing he has to do is spiritually bring the Jewish people back to Judaism, which again, if you think about it, the difference between what's going on today and what went on 50 years ago is 50 years ago, the movement was entirely away from Jewish tradition. But the difference is now, beginning with people like my Rosh Hashiva, Rav Noach Weinberg, you have the Baal Teshuva movement. It's now mainstream. You guys in South Africa, almost your entire community is Baal Teshuva. I mean, it's an incredible phenomenon. It's the most unique, by the way. I've been to every Jewish community pretty much in the world, and South African one is unique in that respect. Then the Messiah has to reinstate Jewish government, halachic government, which means kingship, which of course he is the role, priesthood, which means along with priesthood comes the rebuilding of the temple, on the spot where the Gold Dome stands today. We just imagine how controversial that would be. We're afraid of letting a few Jews pray up there. Can you imagine we remove that Gold Dome and rebuild the temple there? Definitely part of the Messianic concept. The Kohanim go back to the temple service, working in the temple. All that comes back. The Jewish government system of the Jewish court system with the Sanhedrin at the top, that Supreme Court of 71 judges who adjudicate and legislate, the dual function that they were involved in, similar to, using an American analogy, the Congress, the Senate, and the Supreme Court all rolled into one, that all has to be reinstituted. So as we approach the end of the story, the greatest threats are going to face. So as we see all these things coming together, Jews spiritually returning, physical return, reestablishment of a Jewish state after 2,000 years of exile is unbelievable. It's an unprecedented event that a people loses their homeland multiple times, goes into diaspora, which should have wiped us out, experiences the greatest, most universally intense, irrational hatred in human history, survives all of that, comes back and reestablishes a state in the Middle East, which according to people like Ezekiel and Jeremiah talk about the land blooming again, that the desert blooms, and despite having no natural resources and being in a constant state of warfare and terrorism and economic blockade and pariah state, yet prosperous. You have more high tech per capita and more startup. And, Israel, as the Ministry of Tourism used to call Israel, the miracle on the Mediterranean. All of it is a sign. If you stand back and look, none of this is normal. But when I'm talking to audiences about the end of days, Jewish history in general, when you live constantly, there's a great quote from Ben-Gurion. He said, to be a realist as a Jew, you have to believe in miracles, which is all of Jewish history and certainly modern Jewish history. But the problem is when miraculous stuff happens to you all the time, it just becomes normal. And since it doesn't involve the suspension of the laws of nature, the earth splitting and, plagues hitting like they did Egypt 3,300 years ago. So it's not quite as obvious, but if you objectively stand back and look at it, you see that all these signs talking about the good and the bad is all part of the process. And as we get process messianic era time, you could see it's all clearly coming together. So you put it all together, you stand back and you look and you see the description laid out, like Maimonides lays out, and what we expect to see as we approach the Messianic era, physical return, spiritual return, rebirth of the land blooming, the nations of the world coming against us. It's all fitting into place really, really quickly. And Maimonides himself says, he says the Messiah has to do this stuff. And he says, and if he starts to do these things, an individual, the process has begun on their own because God's up there pulling the strings. But he says if a guy comes along and acts as this catalyst, a catalyst in chemistry is supposed to speed up the process. A guy really rises to the top. And I always think about what are we going to expect to see when Messiah comes? It's not going to be one day Messiah's here. I don't believe that for a second. I believe we will first hear about a person. I think about it, not to compare at all. Barack Obama is a guy who was a first term senator that no one really knew about. And before long, suddenly he's within the space of a very short period of time, he's one of the most recognizable people in the world and the president of the United States. So it's a process. I think the same thing will happen with Messiah. A person will come along who will seem to have the leadership skills, the ability to unify the Jewish people, which is the hardest job on the planet Earth. And this process will speed up because that's really what we're lacking in the Jewish world. There is no question in my mind that the one key ingredient we're missing is a person who can get us all on the same page, because the infighting and the disunity in the Jewish world, whether we're talking about in Israel or outside of Israel, by the way, South Africa is one of the most unified Jewish communities I've ever seen. The disunity is unbelievable. And what we're really lacking, and you see the inability of Israel to even form a government, is clearly telling us that there's a bankruptcy in Jewish leadership, and he's that last guy who has to appear. But Maimonides makes it very clear. He says, if a guy starts to do all these things, you can give him the benefit of the doubt. You can call him a potential Messiah, because we have an understanding that such a person is always, floating up there somewhere or in the world, that if we make the right decisions, every generation gets the leadership they deserve. If we make the right decisions, we could bring him. But because we didn't in the past make the right decisions. For instance, Jewish sources talk about King Hezekiah 2,700 years ago. God wanted to make him the Messiah. That would have been nice. Would have saved us a lot of stress. That's the first temple period. But we didn't deserve the Messiah then. So we didn't get them. The difference is between then and now is we may not deserve the Messiah now either. Thankfully, God holds us to a much lower standard of expectation today.
We were criticized for asking for a king before King Saul. Let's just talk about leadership for a minute, right? Right. And if we've learned anything, it's that leadership is fallible. So why even have a Mashiach? Why even have a Messiah? Why can't God do it himself?
First of all, he could. God can do whatever he likes, but it's part of the process of us earning that leadership and getting our act together kind of government. I mean, the problem is not that we asked for a king. I mean, this is a whole big discussion, but we ask for the wrong kind of king. Like, give us a king like all the nations of the world, which is interpreted as like a big guy who'll make all the decisions for us so we can abrogate our responsibility, which is antithetical to Judaism, the Jewish ideas. Yeah, a king is not a figurehead in Judaism, but we're supposed to be a nation of people who take responsibility for ourselves. The king will be a person who's a role model who rallies us, but we're not supposed to abrogate our authority to him. The deeper criticism is the Jewish people saying, just give us a king so we could be like the goyim and give up all the Torah stuff. And because we asked for the wrong kind of king, we got a man who was a great human being, but was not up to the job. But I want to add, very important to add here, Maimonides says something very, very clearly. He says, here's the job description. A guy starts to do it. You give him the benefit of the doubt. You call him a potential Messiah, but you don't give him the title until he finishes the job. So you can have failed messiahs and false messiahs throughout Jewish history. I have a whole class I do just on that topic, but you don't get the title until the job is finished. Which is one of the big problems with Jesus as the Messiah concept. He didn't finish the job. So Christianity came along and said, oh, we'll come back and do it. Second coming. I'm always, when I teach evangelical Christians, I do a lot of teaching for these audiences. They're actually very interesting people who are very big supporters of Israel, some of our truest friends in the world. But I always tell them jokingly at the end, I say, guys, we got to agree to disagree on a few things theologically. Some of them are quite significant, but I'll tell you what, you do your job, I'll do mine. We'll bring the Messiah, and if he's Jesus, you guys can baptize them.
That raises another question, though, is that Judaism, Islam, and Christianity have all got teachings and beliefs about a Messiah. So what would a Messiah mean for all humanity? Because it's clearly not something that's localized.
Well, first of all, Christianity and Islam only exist because of Judaism. They're historical and theological offshoots of Judaism, and all their basic concepts of God and morality and everything else are coming from Judaism and based on, including their messianic concept, whether it's the idea of Jesus in Christianity or the idea of the Mahdi in Islam. So they share a commonality of the whole world united behind a belief system. So in one sense, I always say, like Maimonides, when he talks about the purpose of Christianity and Islam, you know, we look at them in negative light, but he says, no, the reality is before they existed for 2,000 years, it was us and the whole rest of the world were a bunch of often immoral pagans who didn't believe that history had any beginning, point, or ending to it. We're just like stumbling through it. And along comes these two offshoot faiths of Judaism that will convert today billions of people who used to be these polytheists into a worldview that's essentially Jewish. So that's the two steps forward that the whole world, Maimonides says, now talks about history, deterministic view of history moving in one direction and redemption. This is a concept that comes from us, which is an optimistic, empowering concept that replaced the notion of cynical gods who use and abuse you and you serve no purpose except don't go against these guys or they'll crush you. So they absorb that beautiful idea, which gives humanity hope and a direction and a mission and a finish line. But the step backwards and the two step forwards is they think they've replaced us. So they've accepted our idea of God. They've accepted our idea of determinism in history, the idea of morality coming from God. But they just think, okay, but we had a prophet who came along later or his son who did it better kind of thing. You know, like I said, when Mashiach comes, that debate will finally end. Because Maimonides also says in the Messianic era, there is no conversion to Judaism anymore because the essence of conversion is commitment. You got to do it when it's hard. Once Messiah comes, everyone's going to suddenly have this big awakening. I always wanted to be Jewish, but it's not what happens. Too late. But what does the whole world become? Because there's going to be no hunger, no war, no jealousy, no strife, as Maimonides says. There's also going to be no Christianity, no Islam, no Hinduism, no Buddhism. What's the world going to be? Everyone else becomes, and there's no conversion. I once said that in a class, and I said, what does the world become? And a guy yells out, slaves to the Jews. I said, no, it's not the Jewish idea. We're not interested in enslaving the world. The whole world becomes Noahides. They keep the seven laws God gave to Noah, which is like sort of like Judaism light, kind of a slightly watered down basic conception of one God, a justice system, certain basic moral principles. The entire system is designed by the perfect being to be the blueprint, not just for the Jewish people, for all of humanity. And our job is to be the intermediaries and the teachers who bring those concepts to the world. And that's really what the concept is about. Maimonides then goes on to say, it's interesting. He says, no one knows when the Messiah is going to actually come. There's all kinds of speculation. Daniel tried to work out. There's this really interesting esoteric discussion in the book of Daniel about the calculations for the Messiah. It's one of the hardest books of the Bible to understand. But Maimonides says, so no one knows the exact date, but he says, as it gets close, even a child will be able to make the calculation. And, you know, based on what I kind of threw out, all the information about what we expect to see and what's going on in the world and everything fitting together in Jewish tradition, you know, I can't give an exact date, but we're very, very close. I mean, my messaging to everyone is always get to Israel if you can, and at least buy property here if you can. Because you get here now, you can get here comfortably. You get here possibly at the end when it might be a little more intense. It might look like more like Kabul Airport trying to get out there. And that's a good analogy to use. You don't want to be leaving with your handbag and trying to get through on a flight, you know, a rescue mission from somewhere. I'm not saying it's going to happen. Like I said, I am not a prophet. If I was, I'd be working in the stock exchange. But when you have the big picture, you see that really we're a few headlines away from current events, modern history, and this whole messianic concept. We're getting so close. It's moving closer and closer. The good and the bad, the level of threats increasing. Rav Elchanan Wasserman talks about, he says, when you see dangers threaten to overwhelm the Jewish people, expect him. Because that's another idea. You see, just when it's always darkest before the dawn, I always think of that scene in the second Lord of the Rings movie when the orcs are about to anyone saw the movie, is about to overwhelm Helm's Deep, and Gandalf, literally, it's so messianic, on a white horse, with a white robe, with the sun rising behind him, comes down the hill with the cavalry to save the city. That's such a messianic kind of image. You don't want to be in that situation. Ideally, if we get our act together before, it could be like a quick pregnancy where the baby's just sliding out there with very little pain, or it could be, you know, the cavalry has to come over the hill and save us. One way or another, we get there. But how quickly, how painlessly, how quickly, how slowly, how painfully, how painlessly, that's more or less up to the decisions that we make now as the Jewish people. And if we have unity and proactivity, and I think also some aliyah in there, we get to the end of the story as quickly and painlessly as possible.
Basically, we've got 19 years.
Again, I don't know. I'm just saying. There's a Jewish source. I don't want to go into the explanation of that.
Yeah.
In my opinion, just looking at it, things are speeding up incredibly fast. I just saw today that Gantz, you know, he's the Minister of Defense, Benny Gantz. He said that, you know, that Iran is literally within a few weeks, a few months of having a nuclear weapon.
Yeah. We've seen that.
You know, yeah, that is way ahead of the timeline everyone was expecting. And that's the kind of stuff that's a scary wake up call.
Absolutely. The Torah tells us, and as you said earlier, that every generation gets the leadership that it deserves. If Moshe couldn't be the Messiah, and that was the generation that saw the redemption from Egypt, they were on a very high level. They even received the Torah. David couldn't be the Messiah. We know what a great leader he was. Solomon, I mean, the wisdom of Solomon, that was also a great generation. I mean, that's a generation that built the Beis HaMikdash. What chance is there that we are going to see a Messiah at all?
First of all, that generation of the Dor HaMidbar, the generation left Egypt, actually wasn't a very high generation. You have to understand, they were, you know, Jewish sources indicate that they were pretty much assimilated into Egypt. And it's only because of the promise that God made. And, you know, by the way, you see precisely the biggest shakeups, the greatest threats to us, whether it's a Holocaust today or what happens in Egypt, often happen as a consequence of Jewish people, like, just getting too comfortable or too assimilated. That, you know, the more we fall asleep, the bigger the wake up call. It should be a very big wake up call to us about the necessity of being proactive and unified. And you're right. God gives us a guy like King David. The closest we get, by the way, is King Solomon. You know, we get 40 years of peace and prosperity. He inherits a unified little mini empire that his father David built. But again, we blew it because Solomon made some mistakes. He tried to jumpstart the redemption by doing certain things like marrying way too many women, thinking that political alliances would be the greatest way to bring all the leaders of the world to Jerusalem. And you know, he bit off more than he could chew, like Adam eating from the, you know, prematurely eating from the tree of knowledge. That kind of thing. So you're right. It seems like it's hopeless, because if we had these periods of time with open miracles and prophets and great kings, how do we possibly do it today? So like I said before, God expects a lot less from us today. because we don't have these institutions, we don't have a prophet telling us, when you have a person who can speak on behalf of the creator of the universe and you don't listen, boy, is that a big mistake. The consequences for that are much, much greater. And Judaism is very big on that idea of your level of knowledge brings you a higher level of responsibility, and the greater your level of responsibility, the greater your level of accountability, and the greater the impact of the mistakes you make. So clearly those people, it was a double-edged sword there. But like I said before, one way or another, we get to the end of the story. That's the difference between the good and the bad prophecy. So even though we don't really deserve it, and even though we're, you know, Jews in America are assimilating and so many Yidden are lost, you know, throughout the world, God says, I'll get you there. But like I said, the danger in that, like Isaiah says, Achishena bito, I will hasten in its time. The fact that we've waited till so long, and the clock, you know, is 2 minutes to midnight here, as time's running out, you know, like Cinderella trying to get back to the carriage before it turns back into a pumpkin, tells us that we have not made the right decisions collectively. We have gone down very difficult paths, and we've suffered a huge amount because of it. You just look back in history, and that's very clear. Exiles and slaughters and persecution, and you name it. But it's all in the past. To dwell on that is a big mistake. We have to recognize that one way or another we get there. What is in our power now is to, on an individual level, be proactive, work as much towards whatever we can do with our resources, whatever we have, to bringing fellow Jews back. You know, like it's very clear. Maimonides says, we're approaching Rosh Hashanah now. He says, you got to look at the whole world being balanced, and you just doing one little thing could tip the scale in our favor. You know, because God is very merciful and slow to anger, we're told. And he said, salvation can come in the wink of an eye. And we're not even supposed to give up when the sword is at our neck. Never give up hope of mercy from God. So as we're in the very difficult, dangerous period of time and the very low level we're at without the leadership we deserve and all the threats we're facing, we still have to remember that although the odds are stacked against us, our entire history is supernatural. We've outlasted everyone. And the one thing that we have in our control individually and collectively are decisions we make, which is what Rosh Hashanah is all about. It's getting ourselves clear on what decisions we want to make. And the most important decision we have to make is to focus on, and this is my closing thought for Rosh Hashanah, is to remember first and foremost that the purpose of the Jewish people and the purpose of being Jewish is not to serve God and not to learn Torah and do mitzvot. Don't get me wrong, Torah and mitzvot are super important. We don't have a Jewish people without them. Serving God as a figure of speech is infinite. We don't do anything for him. The purpose of the Jewish people has been only one thing in human history, to do Kiddush Hashem, the way to live and act in a way that inspires our fellow Jews and the rest of the world. And we have to be first and foremost, like as we approach Rosh Hashanah, focusing on number one, being super careful not to do anything we're identifiable as Jews that is a desecration of God's name. Everything, even where it's a question of frowning or smiling at someone, has the potential to be a Chil Hashem or a Kiddush Hashem. God forbid, worse things we could do, or better things we could do, for sure, ideally. So we have to be super aware that we can do little things constantly that make a big difference. And we can't just, you know, like we say in the 13 principles, even though he may delay, I'll wait for him, the Messiah. We have to not just wait for him, to proactively try and bring him by proactively doing that Kiddush Hashem and focusing on Jewish unity. To me, it's like a no-brainer that if we just had Jewish unity, the story would end much quicker. And if we had some Jewish proactivity and put some of the energy and drive we have into really doing what we're supposed to do as a people and being that light to nations with the Torah software and that Jewish hardware and that drive that we have, we could bring this story to a very rapid conclusion. Very quickly and painlessly, but that's up to us. That's up to us. And to passively wait for redemption is the biggest mistake we make. So let's hope as we approach this Rosh Hashanah that we get that proactivity and that unity and that consciousness. It has to begin with the religious Jewish world recognizing that it's all about living and acting in a way that inspires people. And we did that, then we get to the end of the story quickly and painlessly. And hopefully we'll see it this year, soon and in our days.
Amen. Rabbi Ken Spiro, thank you so much for taking time for speaking to me this morning.
It really is a privilege.
If you'd like to check out more about what Rabbi Spiro has to say, get to his website. It is kenspiro.com. You can also listen to his history series. You can listen to his other talks. Go and watch the presentation on World Perfect. It is the gift of Jewish values to the world. It's absolutely phenomenal. And what you did your master's on that, didn't you?
That was the book was the first book I wrote, and it was originally my master's thesis that I rewrote as a book afterwards.
Incredible. Thank you so much to Rabbi Spiro. We get so involved in the day-to-day do's and do-nots of Judaism that it's easy to forget that each one of us, each and every person on earth, is not just walking his own unique path, but each one of us forms an important part of a much bigger picture. And sometimes we just have to zoom out and see where we're at in terms of the greater scheme of things. Thank you for joining me. I wish you and yours a Shabbat Shalom.
This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.